And welcome. Good afternoon. Good evening to some. It is Catholic Answers Live getting underway. I am Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett, and it is my extreme honor and pleasure and my blessing to be in the studio here at Catholic Answers in, well, El Cajon, just a little bit east of San Diego. And today we're going to have 2 hours of open forum, question and answer format. And anything you would like to ask Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, you may start calling right now. In fact, the phone lines are already filling up as they typically do at the start of this program. But feel free to grab one of those remaining open lines, 888-318-7884. Q&A means anything you'd like to ask about the faith, the papacy, Mary, scripture, sacraments, liturgy, prayer,
other Christians, other religions, yeah. Bigfoot, UFOs, whatever you want.
Right.
What happened to Amelia Earhart?
Jimmy, well, you know what? You could answer all of those too. I know that.
In fact, on the on tomorrow's episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, we're looking at what happened to Amelia Earhart.
Are you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is the voice of Jimmy Akin, Catholic Answers senior apologist, and it's just a delight to be back here with you again.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure. You were the original host of Catholic Answers Live.
Don't tell
people
anybody.
May not know that.
It's not my fault. Don't blame it on me. No, I was actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
January 5th, 1998, we went on the air on 4 stations.
Yeah. And back then, it was harder to get calls because 4 stations.
Yeah. Yeah. Catholic radio was very, very new back then. But thanks be to God, as you know, that has changed.
Yeah, and hundreds of stations now, as well as the internet.
Yeah, no trouble getting calls. So you may already be getting a busy signal, those of you who are calling in. But we have a lot of lines. We'll get to your questions as best we can. We got 2 hours to get to them. So 888-318-7884. I know before we get to the first question, Jimmy, a lot of people talking about the goings-on at the Vatican these days, and you wanted to just mention quickly about it,
I've been getting questions about a tree planting ceremony that they had at the Vatican recently. I believe it was on St. Francis Day, and it was organized by a group of people who are not part of the Vatican, but the Vatican consented to let them come there and do this. And this is a pretty typical thing that happens. Groups will either come to the Pope at the Vatican or to wherever he may be, if he's like traveling, and they'll do something as a gesture, to promote a cause like, caring for the environment or something, which is what this one was about. Or they'll display their culture in some way. And then the script for how these events work is the people meet the Pope, the people do their thing, and then the Pope gets up and gives like a 2-minute speech that's pre-written where he says nice things. And he says, oh, it's so great that you care about protecting the environment or you have this rich culture or whatever. And he essentially, says nice stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that's how this works. They come, they try to do something that they perceive as nice for the Pope, and then the Pope says nice things. Well, this time, they came and there was some controversy about it because some people, were wondering, are these pagan rites and that they're performing with this tree planting? And, these people are Catholics, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're not also syncretists. There are folk Catholicisms around the world, just like there are folk versions of every religion around the world. And sometimes they mix in elements that are contrary to the gospel. So one could legitimately ask questions about that. In particular, there were some questions raised about a statue, or not a statue, but a carving of a pregnant woman that they had. And there've been different claims about this statue and what it represents. And even bishops at the Vatican who were there for the Amazon Synod, have not been entirely clear on how this statue was to be understood. Some people understood it as just a symbol of, the environment. Apparently, one woman in presenting the statue said, "This is Our Lady of the Amazon." Mm-hmm. And you can supposedly hear her say that, I guess, in Portuguese in the video of the event. So it may be a representation of the Virgin Mary. It may be something else. There are some people who have been saying, oh, it's the Incan goddess Pachamama, or Mother Earth. And I'm going, really? Because number one, these people are Catholics. And number two, the Incas, lived in the mountains on the coast, not in the Amazon basin. That's not where their empire was centered. So I'm kind of skeptical of the idea that these were Incans and that they brought an Inca statue here. But even regardless of how that may be, even if it's a statue of the Virgin Mary, and really the meaning of a statue is the meaning that people, what does it mean in your mind? You know, right. So that has to be taken into account. But even if it's the Virgin Mary, some people were kind of unhappy about it because it happens to be topless. And, you know, that's not uncommon in some native societies in South America and Africa. So it's not the Western mode of dress, but if you have a statue like that, it's definitely going to raise eyebrows among Westerners, and they're going to say, regardless of what people think in their own culture, for Westerners, that's like, whoa, you know, this doesn't seem to correspond to Western pious sensibilities. So people may be uncomfortable with that, and you know who may have been uncomfortable with that? Pope Francis. Because remember the script for what's supposed to happen here. The people come, they do their thing, and then the Pope says nice stuff. That is not what happened here. What happened here is the Pope, who did have his two-minute speech pre-written for him to say nice stuff about these people and what they just did, he, on the fly, set it aside, got up, and said the Lord's Prayer instead. So that saying the Lord's Prayer with a group of visiting people, instead of praising them, this is about the most neutral thing you can do. It's not, you're not deliberately insulting them, but you're also clearly not praising them. And so my read on the situation is the Pope himself looks like he was quite uncomfortable with what was happening, and he did the most diplomatic but neutral thing he could. He did not want to praise these people. He may not have understood what they were doing. You know, that he's not from their culture. He's from Buenos Aires, which is, even though it's in South America, it's not, he's not a native Amazonian tribesperson. And so the way I read it was, you know, there may be grounds for criticism here, and the Pope may share those concerns because he was studiously neutral in this, instead of doing the normal Pope thing, which is say nice stuff about the people who just tried to do something nice for you, and he didn't.
Okay, there you go. Jimmy Akins on top of things, as always, Catholic Answers Live. Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett today. The number 888-318-7884. As expected, we do have full phone lines here. So, Jimmy, I think you're probably all set to go with the
yeah,
calls.
Sure.
Okay. We'll start in Brandon, Florida. George, you are up first today on Catholic Answers Live Thursday Open Forum program. Hi, George.
Hi. I want to start off with a request for Jimmy Akin. I think he's going to be too humble to honor this request, but I would certainly like a biography of him, maybe a 10-minute spiel.
Oh.
I think, Jimmy, you're a brilliant, brilliant individual. I don't know how you can possibly know everything you know, and I would sure like to know your background. I've been listening to you for about 2 months, and
okay,
I am unbelievably impressed with your knowledge.
Oh,
so,
you're very.
If you do have a chance to do a biography someday, I would like that.
Well, let me do just briefly, and then we'll get to your question, but let me just briefly say, I was born in Texas. I was raised in Arkansas. I studied philosophy at the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville. I taught philosophy there in grad school. My academic training is in philosophy, but I'm also what's technically called an autodidact, which means a self-teacher. And so I'm just constantly studying and try to learn new things. And I have a lot of the joy of discovery and learning new things in my life. And so that's what I do for fun. In terms of further biographical information, actually, I wrote an account of my conversion to the Catholic faith. It's called A Triumph and a Tragedy, and it's available online at jimmyakin.com. So if you just Google Jimmy Akin, A Triumph and a Tragedy, or maybe even just Jimmy Akin Conversion Story, it should come up.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank
sure.
You. Once again, I'm very impressed with your knowledge. I love listening to you. So,
well, thank you. You're very kind.
My question is regarding baptism. What is the implications to a person who is told they were baptized, because Catholics baptize infants, and I was baptized as an infant. And come to find out, what would happen to a person's soul if they were not baptized, as they were told they were by their parents?
Well, are you talking about during their life or when they die?
When they die.
Okay.
Absolutely, for their salvation.
Okay, so the church acknowledges that sacramental baptism is ordinarily required for salvation. It's the ordinary means that God has provided for us to be put into a state of grace, but it's not the only means by which one can enter a state of grace. And in particular, one of the things that that the church acknowledges as being able to put you in a state of grace is what's known as baptism of desire. Baptism of desire can be either explicit, meaning you have a conscious desire for baptism, and this is the case, for example, with catechumens who are preparing to come into the church. And it's also it can also be implicit. This is in the case of a person who doesn't say no, they need to be baptized, but would want to be baptized if they knew that, because they want to do whatever God wants. And the church holds that it's possible for someone to be saved by baptism of desire. So if someone had not been baptized as a baby, but thought they had been, and if they affirmed that and say, yeah, I'm glad I was baptized as a baby, I want the graces that come from baptism, then that would count as a form of conscious baptism of desire. They just think they've been baptized, but they consciously are affirming and desiring baptism. And so that would make it possible for them to be saved through that means.
How's that, George?
Okay, I appreciate that. No, that helps. Thank you.
All right.
Awesome.
And watch for the movie, Jimmy Akin's biography. But that's after the book comes out.
I don't think I'll be around to see that movie.
Well, Austin and Dennis and John and Tom and Brian, hang on. This is Catholic Answers Live. I am Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett. And have you checked out the Great Fall Sale at theshop.catholic.com yet? Every year at this time, Catholic Answers makes available the finest in faith resources, apologetics, evangelization, anything that you might be looking for. And right now they have books, booklets, CDs, DVDs, ebooks, MP3s, e-magazines, you name it. It is all on sale, slashed in prices. And that includes all of Jimmy Akin's books and ebooks and resources as well. So visit today, theshop.catholic.com. Check out the great savings. And you'll also get $5 flat rate shipping in the continental United States. That's shop.catholic.com.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Catherine Zeltner.
There are so many misconceptions when it comes to abortion and assisted suicide. It's really confusing, and I think for a lot of people, they don't know how to talk about these things. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, we help to change that. We help to really untangle these web of lies. Listeners can expect to become informed and then grow more confident so that they can then discuss and dialogue these issues, and together we can really impact culture in that way.
EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on EWTN Radio.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features daily Mass, prayers, articles, and meditations in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church. On the web at magnificat.com.
Okay, we go right back to your calls, and Jimmy Akin is here for this hour and next hour on this Thursday Q&A program. As promised, Austin is next, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app in Louisiana. Hi, Austin. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. Jimmy, my question is about a papal bull issued by Pope Boniface VIII called Unum Sanctum.
Uh-huh.
And basically what it means is that submission to the Pope is necessary for salvation. Now, I understand that we have to recognize the Pope's office and how special it is, but I'm curious as to what the connection is between, you know, we have to honor his office, and then it's also necessary for salvation. I just can't kind of connect that.
Okay. So this document, which was released in the early 1300s, is one that was controversial at the time. It was part of a conflict that the Pope was having with the King of France. And it was ambiguous at the time exactly what he meant. People, because the way the document's phrased, it talks about submitting to the Roman pontiff. And at the way that the church historically, you know, in the Middle Ages and even for some time afterwards, would talk about church-state relations, it would talk about there being two powers. There is the sword, the temporal sword and the spiritual sword. And the temporal sword was wielded by the secular government, the civil government, and like the King of France, he would have the temporal sword. And then the spiritual sword was exercised by the church and in its highest form by the Pope. And so a question arose immediately of, does this document mean that kings have to obey the Pope in political matters? And Boniface himself clarified this, not in the document itself, but afterwards he clarified this to say, no, of course not. The temporal authorities have their own sphere of activity and their own authority and their own sphere. So I'm not saying the Pope has to obey, or the King of France has to obey the Pope in matters of civil government. It's in the fact he's a Christian that he needs to submit to the Pope. So what does that mean? Well, and why is it connected with salvation? Well, Christ connected salvation with being a member of his body, and his body is the church. So as the Second Vatican Council says in its document, Lumen Gentium, Christ willed that we find salvation by entering the church, which we do as through a door, through baptism. So we need to enter the church through baptism. This is the ordinary means of you know, finding salvation. As we mentioned in the previous call, there are other ways that God can save you, even if you're not baptized. But the way he set out for us to pursue salvation is to be baptized and enter his son's mystical body, the church, where we receive all the spiritual graces we need to go to heaven. But you need to stay in that body, because if you leave that body, if you separate yourself from Christ's mystical body, then you're separating yourself from the sources of grace that he's making available to you. And if you do it through your own fault, you're culpably separating yourself from God's body, from Christ's body, and saying, I don't want these graces from God. At least I don't want them enough to stay in his church and do what he said I need to do. And since the Pope is the head of the earthly church and has authority over religious matters in the church, one needs to submit to the Pope's legitimate authority within the church. Jesus gave Peter the keys of the kingdom. He gave him the power to bind and loose, and one needs to respect that as a member of the church. And if one doesn't, then you're separating yourself from the church, you're breaking unity, and either going into heresy or schism or, in a worse case, apostasy. And that cuts you off from the, if you do it knowingly and deliberately, that cuts you off from the graces that flow from Christ to us through his church. So does that help you out?
Oh, no, that's a great answer. Reason why I was asking, because I was watching a Netflix series called Nightfall, and it showed Pope Boniface VIII in like some sort of authoritative, you know, character, and he was saying to the King of France, you know, I'm about to issue this papal bull, submit or be damned. I'm like, that's a good question to ask to Jimmy Akin. What does he have to say about that?
Uh-huh.
But no, that's a great answer. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good to have you with us, Austin, here on Catholic Answers Live. 888-318-7884 is the number to call to get on that line that Austin had occupied there. And we're going to go to Dennis now in Michigan. Dennis, welcome to our Thursday Q&A program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, Dennis. How are you?
Not bad. I'm not a Catholic, but I did have a question regarding the concept of faith plus works for salvation. Question's kind of two-parted. So how do you measure works and know when you've done enough? And what about a person who might have came to Christ on a deathbed conversion but didn't have an opportunity to do works?
Okay. So this question presents me with a great opportunity to clarify some ideas that are out there that, frankly, even sometimes you'll hear Catholics and even some Catholic apologists saying. You'll sometimes hear Catholics say things like, and you'll hear Protestants say this too, that Catholics believe we're saved by faith plus works, or that we're justified by faith plus works. And that's not a phrase that the church uses. If you look in official church documents, including ones from the Council of Trent or the Catechism of the Catholic Church, or most recently the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification that the Catholic Church signed with various Protestant communities, that phrase is never used. The magisterium does not use the phrase justified by faith and works. So this is a popular misconception. So what does the church say? Well, if you read these various documents, and in particular, if you read what the Council of Trent said in its decree on justification, this was the council, Dennis, since you mentioned you're not a Catholic, this was the council that responded to the Protestant Reformation back in the 1500s. And one of its documents was called the Decree on Justification. And in it, it said that nothing that we do prior to a state of justification, whether faith or works, is capable of meriting justification. So justification is something that God gives us by his grace. Now, he ordinarily gives it to us through baptism, but he has other ways of giving it to us. But good works play no role at all in earning justification. In fact, Catholic theology would hold that it's not even possible to do supernaturally good works prior to being in a state of justification, because it requires the virtue of charity or the supernatural love of God to do those works. And prior to being justified, we don't have charity in our souls. Charity is one of the graces that God gives us. And so the paradigm is not do good works to get justified. The paradigm is accept God's grace and be justified. And then one of the graces he gives you is the virtue of charity, which allows you to do supernaturally good works that are pleasing to him. And he will reward you for those good works, but they're not what allows you to go to heaven. And so there's not some number of good works that you have to do in order to get into heaven. If a person comes to God at the last moment of their life and accepts his grace at that moment and has no opportunity to do good works, that person's going to heaven. So praise God. It's great that we don't have to do good works in order to get into heaven. We receive his grace. We want to receive it the way he wants us to receive his grace. And then once we've done that, we want to do good things to please him. And he does reward what we've done in the afterlife. But you don't have to do any certain number of good works to get into heaven. Just accepting his grace and being justified is enough. And so consequently, since we don't have to worry about, well, have I done enough good works, we don't have to have a system for measuring good works objectively. I mean, you want to use your common sense to say, what would please God more? I want to do as much as I can to please God, but I want to do it because I want to please God, because I love him, not because this is the only way I'm going to get into heaven.
What do you think, Dennis? Any other thoughts you want?
Yeah, I mean, the way you just explained it, it sounded kind of like just the way a Protestant would say it. So I don't know really why there's any division there.
It's partly because of, you know, historical difficulties and miscommunication between the different communities on this. I have a book, and Dennis, if you can hang on, I'd like to see about having a copy sent to you. I wrote a book called The Drama of Salvation, where I go into this. I also have a shorter book called 20 Answers Salvation. And if you can hang on, we'll take your contact information and send you those, and you can read up on it more.
Okay, Dennis, thank you. Yeah, thank you for the call, and you'll be in our prayers, and we would appreciate you keeping us in prayer as well. It's Jimmy Akin here, 2 hours of open forum on this Thursday, tomorrow. And actually, Jimmy, you're back, I mean, today, tomorrow you're back for the second hour tomorrow.
Yeah, and tomorrow we're going to be doing Why Aren't You a Catholic?
Yeah.
So it's going to be an opportunity to interact with a lot of our non-Catholic friends, whether they're Protestant or Jewish or Muslim or Buddhist or atheist or agnostic or whatever they may be. We're going to be devoting tomorrow's second hour specifically to your questions. So if you're one of our friends who's not a Catholic, get your questions ready for tomorrow.
Okay, and more of you will be on the air here shortly, beginning with, we'll resume with John in just a moment in New Orleans, Tom in Ann Arbor. We got Brian and Josh and Debbie in Omaha. It's 888-318-7884 is the toll-free number to get on Catholic Answers Live today. I am Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett. You can catch me on most of these same EWTN radio stations. Take Two with Jerry and Debbie at noon Eastern Time, Monday through Friday, with a replay at midnight Eastern Time. Hope you can tune in and join us for one of those programs. Again, we'll have more of your calls and questions for Jimmy Akin straight ahead.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible, Jimmy Akin's The Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
And I want to thank the show team. Again, as I said the other day, I would start naming names, but I know I'd miss some people. But a great team that puts Catholic Answers Live together in the other room there.
Yeah, Nick, Marie, and Thomas.
Okay, Nick, Marie, and Thomas. Yeah, they're all just fist pumping in there. They're doing the chest bumps and stuff. And they're excited about
chest
it.
Chest bumps.
Well, you know, in sports where you run up and people jump up and, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a lot of weird and dangerous stuff. If I was a coach, I'd say, don't do that.
Okay.
Because some players have gotten hurt, you know. They make too much money to get hurt doing silly stuff like that.
They need to get hurt other ways.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And they
save it for the game.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, back to your calls to New Orleans. John is listening on AM 690 there, Catholic Community Radio. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you guys? I really appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
My question has to do really with the validity of Mary and Joseph's marriage by today's teaching. My friend and I, Leighton, were having a discussion, and if we believe in Mary's perpetual virginity, then Joseph and her would have never consummated their marriage. So as a result, by church standards and teaching today, can their marriage be considered void?
No. Marriage does not require that you actually consummate. So the minute you exchange matrimonial consent, you know, the minute you say, I do, you're married. And you don't have to wait until the wedding night to when you consummate, typically, to be married. You're married the moment you both consent. And in fact, if you weren't, then you shouldn't be consummating, because it's being married that enables you to have marital congress with your spouse. You need to be married first, then you get to consummate. It's not the consummation that brings about the marriage. And so consequently, even though as part of marital consent, you do give a person the right to have marital congress with you, they don't have to necessarily exercise that right. And so there have been marriages down through history where people have said, okay, I'm marrying you, I'm giving you the right to this, but neither party is planning on exercising that right. And these are sometimes called Josephite marriages, because it's the kind of marriage that St. Joseph had with Mary. And so the Catholic Church would look at their marriage and say it was a valid marriage. They exchanged matrimonial consent. They had the right to have relations with each other, but they chose not to do so for various reasons, including Mary giving birth to the Son of God.
Is that helpful, John?
Yep, that's perfect. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for the call from New Orleans. We go to New York next. Brian listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hello, Brian. You're on with Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Jimmy. How you doing? So in Matthew 8, where the demons beg Jesus to send them into the swine, mm-hmm. Would that be seen as the demons praying to Jesus, or at least having faith in him?
Okay. So if I heard you correctly, could it be understood as the demons praying to Jesus and having faith in him? In regard to the first question, yes, because the word pray originally just meant ask. And it comes from the Latin verb precare, which means to make a request or to ask. And they were clearly making a request of Jesus. So yeah, they were praying to Jesus based on the old sense of the word pray, which is still used in a lot of different contexts. It gets used that way in court documents, for example. If you file a motion with the court, down at the bottom of it, your lawyer is going to have a prayer for relief, or something equivalent, where he says, my client prays that the court does this. And he's not talking to God. He's talking to the judge, saying, I'm asking you, the judge, to do this. You get the same thing in older British circles. Like if you read older British literature, you'll have people saying, I pray you do this, when they're talking to some other person here on earth. And they're not worshiping that person. They're just asking them to do something. And you even get a contraction that comes from that, prithee, which is a contraction of I pray thee or I ask you. And so the demons were asking Jesus to do something that would count as praying in the standard historical sense of the term. Now, in some circles in the English-speaking world, and in particular this happens among our Protestant friends, but it's even spilled over into some other circles, the word prayer has been associated uniquely with worshiping God. And are the demons worshiping God here by making this request? Well, they clearly know he's God, and they clearly know he's got the authority to answer their request. And worship can be understood in more than one sense. In the fundamental sense, it's attesting to someone's worth. That's why it's called worship. You're acknowledging someone's worth or the different qualities that they genuinely have. And so they're acknowledging Jesus genuinely has the authority to do this. So in that minimal sense, you could even say they're worshiping Jesus. But that kind of rubs against the way we normally use the word, where we mean love and adore and praise. And they're not doing that. They're on the other team. So they don't like Jesus, they're afraid of Jesus, they do not love Jesus, and consequently, they are not worshiping Jesus in the normal sense that we use the term. What about faith, the second part of your question? Well, it is possible for demons to have a sort of faith. James talks about this in chapter 2 of his letter. He says, you believe that God is one? Good for you, so do the demons, and yet they shudder at the prospect of God's wrath. And so these demons are shuddering at the prospect of God's wrath right here. That's why they're making the request about the pigs. But that means they also believe. So they have a kind of intellectual faith. which is the kind James says is inadequate. It doesn't fully please God to just have an intellectual faith. What they don't have is a faith where they are trusting in God for salvation, or where they have a faith that works through love, the kind that St. Paul says saves us. So they don't have the kind of faith that you need to be saved, but they do have a kind of bare intellectual faith in the truths of Christian doctrine. They know Jesus is God. They know he has this power and so forth.
What do you think, Brian?
No, that was great. Thank you so much.
No problem.
All right. Good to have you with us on this Thursday. 2 hours of Q&A open forum on Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin answering your questions. We'll go to Josh next, who is in Columbia, Maryland. He is watching the video stream on YouTube Live. Hey, Josh, welcome.
Hey, how you doing? My question involves Catholic eschatology.
Okay.
So I understand Catholics generally are amillennial, but I'm wondering how you guys interpret the book of Revelation normally. Like, I know many Protestants believe the Pope is the Antichrist, which I'm assuming you guys don't believe that.
No. And actually, I don't think it's very many Protestants these days, although you will find that in some older Protestant documents.
Yeah, that's true. Because I used to be a Protestant. I'm in RCIA.
Uh-huh.
And none of my old Protestant churches believe that, but some hardcore, Presbyterians and Lutherans still believe that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, how do you guys interpret the Bible? Is it more like historical, like preterist or futurist? Mm-hmm.
So the church doesn't mandate a specific view of the book of Revelation. It allows, and I should even go back up a little bit because not everyone listening may understand one of the terms that we just used, amillennialism. In Revelation chapter 20, there's a period of 1,000 years where Christ and the saints reign and the devil is bound. So he's not able to, among other things, stop the proclamation of the gospel. And there are different positions regarding how this passage about the millennium should be interpreted. One position is known as premillennialism, and this view holds that Christ will return to the earth physically, bodily, before the millennium. That's why it's called premillennialism. He returns pre or before the millennium. And so then he would be physically on earth during the millennium. And then at the end of the millennium, there would be an outbreak of evil, and then we'd have the final judgment and the resurrection of the dead and things like that, the final resurrection. Another view is called postmillennialism. And postmillennialism holds that Christ returns after the millennium and things get really awesome good in the millennium. So you have this progressive triumph of the gospel over the world, and then at the end of that is kind of the capstone, Jesus comes back, and it's all good. I mean, there may be some evil in there at various places, but the millennium is still in our future, and it's going to just be wicked awesome, like, you know, Star Trek only with God. And then Jesus will come back. Now, neither of those is the historic Catholic understanding, and even neither one of them was the main Protestant understanding at the time of the Reformation. Instead, the majority position throughout Christian history, including at the time of the Protestant Reformation, is a position that now is sometimes called amillennialism. That's not really a great name because a is a Greek prefix that means no, and so you sometimes have this position characterized as saying there is no millennium, but that's not how amillennialists understand it. Instead, amillennialists will say, no, there is a real millennium, and Jesus comes back after it, so he's reigning from heaven and through the church on earth during the millennium, and it's a good period in that the devil is bound and can't stop the proclamation of the gospel, so the gospel can go out and convert people. It's just we shouldn't expect a magical golden age. So it's not as good of a, it's not as positive an era as postmillennialism would hold, but it's still a good era. The world is not swallowed in pagan darkness now the way it was before Christ. So that's what amillennialism means, and that's the historic Christian position, the majority Christian position, all the way down through history, and even reformers like Luther and Calvin were amillennialists. Now, how do we relate that to the book of Revelation? Well, as I mentioned, the church doesn't mandate a particular view of the book of Revelation. There are a number of common options. The big ones are futurism, historicism, idealism, and preterism. Futurism holds that most of the book of Revelation is still in the future. So, you know, like what you're reading in chapter 7 and 8, long before you get to chapter 20, that's all still in our future. Historicism says that the events of Revelation are sort of stretched out over the course of history fairly evenly between the beginning of Christian history and the end of history. So it's, and there are a couple of different versions of historicism. One of them says that it's like a roadmap of Christian history. So when you hit chapter 7, you're, I don't know, in the 7th century. And when you hit chapter 9, you're in the 10th century. And when you hit chapter 13, you're in the 15th century or something like that. This is used to be a much more common view than it is now. This version of historicism, it's not common now because all such attempts to map Revelation onto church history have failed. It just does not map onto church history in any kind of straightforward linear way. And that's led to another version of historicism that says Revelation does cover all of church history in a kind of even way, but it does so in a cyclical way. So through, as you read through Revelation, you will, it keeps looping back to the beginning of church history and then retelling church history from a different perspective. And so you're getting new information in each cycle about church history and about God's plan, but you shouldn't look for it to map onto church history just like a timeline would. Then there's a position known as preterism. Preterism, which Josh also mentioned, preterism, you can hear the pre in that. And the idea of preterism is most of the book of Revelation occurred early in church history, before now, pre now. And preterism is not mandated by the church. You can hold one of these other views. But I personally, and this is just me, but I personally find the arguments for preterism the most convincing. If you look at the beginning and the end of Revelation, it is stressed that what the book contains is being revealed to show Christ's servants what will happen soon. And just taking that language at face value, soon would seem to be soon from the perspective of a first century audience, not a 20th century audience or a 30th century audience, but soon at the time the book was written. And that would suggest that at least most of the material in Revelation should be bunched up either in the first century or in the first few Christian centuries. Now, then we get up in chapter 20, where we hit the millennium, and suddenly there's this long period of time. Doesn't have to be literally 1,000 years. 1,000 years can be a symbol for even a much longer period, but that's how I would take it. I think most of Revelation up to the beginning of chapter 20 deals with early church history. We are now living in the 1,000-year period where Christ is reigning in heaven and through the church on earth, and the devil is bound so that he can't stop the proclamation of the gospel and can't stop people coming to Jesus. And then at some point in the future, the devil will become unbound, and there will be a great persecution and a great falling away, and the church will really be hurt by that. But Christ at that point will return and usher in the eternal order. So that's how I personally would take it, but there are other legitimate ways of looking at the book.
What do you think about that, Josh?
That's pretty good.
Okay. If you want to read more about that, I've written a number of things about it. You can just Google Jimmy Akin Revelation and Jimmy Akin Millennium and things like that, and a bunch of stuff will pop up. Jimmy Akin Preterism will also pull up stuff.
Okay, Josh?
Sounds good.
All right. You are in our prayers as you are on your faith journey, and please do keep us posted and call the program anytime. 888-318-7884. That is the number to get on this program. It's a Q&A open forum on Thursday. Jimmy Akin here this hour, and he's going to stick around for hour number two, so that we hope you will as well. And just want to mention before we get back to your calls and questions that Jimmy has put together a new online video course, and you can find it at Catholic.com. The Bible is a Catholic book. Do you want to know why? Well, let Jimmy Akin teach you all about that. Don't wait another minute to sign up for this free course. Just go to Catholic.com, and as you scroll down near the bottom of the page, you'll see a free video course tile, and you can enroll today. And you're going to get five videos, one per week for 5 weeks, on Scripture alone, the Bible in the Catholic Church, God's Word in the New Testament, the Word of God incarnate, and the Word of God before the Bible. So take advantage of this opportunity from your friends at Catholic Answers. Just go to Catholic.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the page and enroll today in the free video course, The Bible is a Catholic Book.
We're ready and waiting for your call today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The best way to pray is simply to open our minds and our hearts to God, to allow His presence to begin to fill us, to restore us, to refresh us, to make us new. The best way to pray is simply to be aware of that presence and to say yes to it, to give fiat to that presence as our Blessed Lady did. In that way, we delight in prayer and God Himself delights in us.
Okay, without any further delay, we go right back to your calls for Jimmy Akin, answering your apologetics and faith questions. And we're going to go to Omaha, Nebraska. Debbie has the program on Spirit Catholic Radio. We love our friends there at Spirit Catholic Radio. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Jimmy. I have a question for you. It follows up from the previous caller in reference to baptism.
Mm-hmm.
I have three grandbabies, two from my daughter and one from my son.
Mm-hmm.
And all three have not been baptized yet because we're unable to find a priest that will baptize them because my kids are not married. And they have been told that because they are living in sin, they will not baptize my grandbabies. And I'm having a very hard time with this.
Okay. This is a misapplication of canon law, frankly. This is not what canon law says should happen. If you look in, and you can always go back and get this reference, but I'm going to, just for your information, I'm going to read you what canon law says. This is canon 868 of the Code of Canon Law, and it says, for an infant to be baptized licitly, that means lawfully or in accordance with the provisions of the law, for an infant to be baptized licitly, the parents or at least one of them or the person who legitimately takes their place, meaning like a legal guardian, must consent. So you need either the parents, one of them, or the guardian to consent. Two, there must be a founded hope that the infant will be brought up in the Catholic religion. If such a hope is altogether lacking, the baptism is to be delayed according to the prescripts of particular law after the parents have been advised about the reason. And then in section 2 of the canon, it says an infant of Catholic parents or even non-Catholic parents is baptized licitly in danger of death, even against the will of the parents. So as long as these children are not in danger of death, you shouldn't baptize them. You need to take them to the church for that. But there's nothing in this canon about being born out of wedlock, or having parents who are living in sin. There's nothing here about that. The closest thing is this requirement that there must be a founded hope that the infant will be brought up in the Catholic religion. Okay. That has nothing to do with whether the parents are shacking up. I mean, yeah, it's a bad witness to the child. If the parents are not married and they're living with someone outside of marriage, that's a bad witness. But that doesn't mean that the child can't be brought up in the Catholic faith. The child can be baptized. The child can be taken to church, be given the sacraments, all of that. There is not a reason here for denying baptism under canon law. And sometimes you will have pastors, and I understand this impulse, you'll have pastors who will want to encourage people to get their lives together, you know, by, like, say, getting married, and they'll use the child as the baptism of the child as kind of a lever to try to get the parents to do what they ought. And that may be what's happening here, where the priest is delaying the baptism to try to get the parents to respond. But ultimately, push comes to shove, these children can be baptized. And so if you continue to have problems, I mean, I'd go to another parish and say, you know, here's the situation. I know what Canon 868 says, and these kids need to be baptized, and one or both of the parents consent, and they're going to raise them in the Catholic Church. We want to do what we can to support them in that, but if you continue to have problems, I'd go to the bishop. I'd write the bishop a letter and say, I'd like to get the situation addressed. And frankly, Pope Francis has actually had some rather strong words about priests who restrict baptism, the baptism of children, when canon law does not require them to do so. Typically punishing the child for the sins of the parents. And he's had some quite strong words for priests who do that.
Because we've been to two priests already, mm-hmm. two separate parishes,
uh-huh.
and we're told the same thing.
Then I would go to the bishop.
Okay.
And if you have, don't get satisfaction there, there's further recourses, you know, from there. But that's the next logical step.
Okay.
Also, you might consult with the St. Joseph Foundation in San Antonio, Texas. They're a group that's founded to help lay people get their ecclesial rights honored. And so they may also be of assistance.
That's the St. Joseph
Foundation in San Antonio, Texas. And they have a website. Just search for them. You'll find them.
Yeah, you'll find them very easily. All right, Debbie, thank you for joining us on the program today. We appreciate that. We're going to continue into hour number two with Jimmy Akin. I think we can get to Mike in Columbus before we wrap up the first hour, listening on St. Gabriel Radio. Hi, Mike. You're on with Jimmy Akin.
Hello.
Hey, Mike. Go as
Mike,
quickly
you're
as you
on
can.
The air. What's your question?
Got about 2 minutes before the top of the hour break.
Oh, yes, sir. I'm just wondering about contradictions in the Bible, and my specific example is the thieves on the cross. And two of the Gospels, it says that one thief defended Jesus and so forth, and the other two Gospels, it says that both thieves ridiculed Jesus, and I would like to know what the right answer is and what you do about contradictions in the Bible.
I need to give you an answer quickly because we're going to hit the top of the hour, but there are a variety of ways of dealing with proposed contradictions. In this case, there's not an actual contradiction. The different Gospels are just recording different aspects of the story. The standard understanding down through history is that both of the other criminals initially mocked Jesus, and then as they learned more about him and saw his witness on the cross, one of them turned around and had a different opinion, just like the Roman soldier did at the foot of the cross. He says, by the end of it all, surely this man was the Son of God, because he was so impressed by how Jesus handled himself on the cross and by his witness as he was dying. And so the church has simply understood that happened with one of the thieves, too. I've got a little short book called 20 Answers Bible Difficulties that goes into ways of approaching these issues and trying to figure them out. So I'd suggest getting a copy of that, 20 Answers Bible Difficulties.
And you'll find that at mikeshop.catholic.com. I'm sure that's part of the annual fall sale that's going on there right now. So everybody hustle on over there during this few minute break here. Jimmy Akin is going to stick around. I hope that you will too. If you are on the line, you will lead off in hour number two. I'm Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett. Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.